This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Duncan Curtis, who's the SVP for Gen AI and AI Product and Technology at SAMR. That's quite a mouthful of a title, Duncan.
Yes, I would agree. It certainly is, Ian.
Do you want to tell us a bit about you and SAMR?
I run our engineering, machine learning, product management, and design and UXR teams here at SAMR. That means that I really do see across the breadth of Gen AI, AI, and computer vision, and we call them out because across our customer base, those are very specific needs. Sometimes if you're looking for one of those particular ones, that my title needed to match what our customers are often looking for. But that means a little bit about me, computer science degree, ex-Google, ex-Zoox, been in autonomous vehicles and AI for a long time. At SAMR, what we do here is that we help some of the world's largest companies develop their AI. We help specifically in the data category, where our expertise is annotation. We were founded as a not-for-profit entity because we believe that talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. So we're B Corp certified, and we help people out of East Africa connect with the digital economy and help drive AI forward.
With all the number of AI companies out there, you came to my attention purely because you talk about multimodal. Something which most people don't understand, and they don't understand why we need it. Do you want to give people just a quick heads up from your side as to what multimodal is and what it gives us?
That's a really good point. And I find that trying to make it easy to understand can be difficult, but let me give my best shot. The idea of multimodality at its core is a lot of AI has single modality. That might be text. It might be computer vision with a camera. Think of a security camera or your Ring doorbell might just be computer vision based. You might just have a chatbot that is only NLP or text based. The idea of multimodality is when you take multiple ones of those and you put them together as different data sources for the AI to be able to make decisions about what it's trying to achieve. Now, why do you need multiple modalities? What I go back to is, as humans, we have many modalities available to us. We have our eyes. We also have our ears. We have our sense of touch. We have a sense of smell. We have our hearing. And all of those go together to give us a multimodal experience that makes it much easier for us to make decisions in the real world. Why we see the drive towards multimodality is that it adds additional capabilities. Each modality generally brings its own strengths and weaknesses. And by pairing them up, when you do it well, you can focus on the strength of each modality to have a 1+1=3 outcome.
But for most people, they look at AI and their experience is Gen AI, exclusively text-based. It's come out of machine learning. It's come out of other things that we've done beforehand. When we talk about using video and music, again, they see these, as you said at the beginning, as very focused solutions. Bringing them all together and making them more human-like in this use of senses, how does that change the types of applications that you see us using it for?
I'd like to touch on autonomous vehicles at some point because I think it's a great example.
Well, as a LiDAR engineer, I was expecting you to go there.
I like the human angle. So let's look at generative AI and how it can do things. Even with video, we've seen some recent releases in how we're continuing to make really interesting steps forward in that place. It's often multimodality to begin with, where you're taking a text prompt to then generate a video, and then you might have, you know, multiple loops in there to get a video going. But the reason it allows for a more human type context is that when I think about how I process as a human, my day-to-day work and job. Maybe I'm using a ChatGPT or a generative AI model, but when I think about the work I'm trying to automate to make myself more effective, I'm not just looking at text. I might be watching YouTube videos. I might be watching podcasts. I might be browsing the internet to do some research as well. I might be looking through some documents that might be internal documents as well. And if I really want to go through and form opinions or to gain information about something, it is very rare in the real world that it is single modality. We've seen the single modality really push forward because that was the capabilities we had, a chatbot that was only text. There's a reason we saw those because single modality came first.
It's also a simpler thing to do. But many people have been pulled into that single modality world. They look at ChatGPT as a replacement for multiple sources of information. People don't go to a library anymore. They don't look at multiple sources of information to form an opinion. They got to the point of asking Google. At least Google will throw you up images and other things. Your in-browser AI is giving you a text stream, often lacking a lot of that context that we pick up from our human senses. How do you change that from a wider usage perspective?
One of the things I've tracked over time is the usage of ChatGPT or other in-browser AIs versus people going to Google. It's fascinating to me to see something that has become a verb, to just go Google something and to figure it out, is now going to become, I GenAI'd it to get there. So I've been watching the trends on how that's been adopted. And I've got several friends who, I don't Google things anymore. I just go here. And it's fascinating. I love that you called out that people are actually accepting a limitation without realizing it, where they're like, it figured all of that out for me. And now I'm just going to have this text-based interaction. What we're going to see in the limited adoption or the rate of adoption of that change will increase when they can start adding some of that content in there. Why don't you have images as part of your response? Why don't you have video content as part of your response? It's been interesting to see, because the proprietary nature of ChatGPT obviously being closed sourced, they're not a monolithic tech company in their own sense where they can just say, let me include OpenAI Tube videos as part of that content and still be able to monetize it. I would not be surprised if I see companies like Google with Gemini be some of the leaders who say, we've already got all of this other content that we do on our search page. Why don't we have it in here? But I haven't seen that happen yet.
But that takes us into very dangerous territory, the whole issue of copyright versus AI. What is fair usage? What isn't fair usage? Just because it's out on the internet, not behind a paywall, doesn't mean you can steal it.
No, nor does it mean it's good. I just want to call that out as another key point. While these are trained on the majority of the internet, doing random Googling does not mean the answers are right. I have children, but it's one of the things having to explain to my 8 and 10-year-old is, but I saw it on YouTube, and I'm like, well, why don't we sit down? And this is the process I walk with them. We recorded a video. We lied in the video intentionally. And then we uploaded it to YouTube. And I said, so does this make it true? And suddenly the light bulb went off. It doesn't have to be right and accurate and fact checked.
That raises an interesting issue around multimodal. And it's kind of taking us away from where I thought we'd go, but it's worth exploring here. And that is fact checking. You watch a bit of video. You don't know if it's fake, if it's real, if there's misinformation in the video or not. Most people seem to just take things at face value today. But we know from being inside the industry how easy it is to distort those facts, to change the truth. You only have to slightly distort it and suddenly you push people down a different path. Is there a place for multimodal to become a trusted fact checker by being able to compare multiple videos, multiple sources of audio, multiple sources of text, and become my AI Snopes across all my sources of media?
Wow, that's fascinating. I want to add one extra detail before we go to an answer for it. How much of the content it's reviewing is AI generated? Because that's becoming more and more of a case as we go there. So there's a little bit of the who's checking who and checking itself in there. But that's a really fascinating concept, because being able to truly multimodally look through multiple things, and the use case I was going to give you on how do you trust things online now, I want to just share a very interesting phenomenon that I've seen. There's now a set of short form content where people have seen a video, I'm not sure whether it's true or not, and these people then go and test the recipe or test whatever the thing is as a way to fact check. And that's actually interesting content for people, because they're not saying, hey, I came up with this idea and I'm amazing. We're going to see if it's real or not. Can you make a recipe with only 3 ingredients in a minute in a microwave and it tastes delicious?
But I've seen some of those, and these people put this stuff in their mouth.
They do. Look, they're putting their lives on the line for fact-checking, and I got to applaud them for that. What I'm trying to suggest here is that I think it's an underlying current and trend that people are trying to find other ways to have a Snopes-like experience, but in a short form, so that you have some trust behind it. And it does not help, by the way, that every time you engage with generative AI, even multimodal ones, that it says, I am not a trusted source of information. You must verify all facts underneath. And I'm like, technically, I guess everyone doing that video content should also do the same thing, but they're not large companies that are legally liable for the stupid things people may do with that information. I would love to see multimodality unlock a category of generative AI that is about building up. Maybe we need something like a trust score, something that's live, that can be something that's an open standard, that can be a process that's understood, that has where the sources of information came from, how it was assessed, and give you that your fair trade coffee certified levels of like, how good is this? You would need multimodality to be able to do that.
Let's talk about how we get to that point with multimodality. And perhaps this filters maybe into your product launch from February, where you had your agentic AI launch, which was designed to enable some degree of multimodality. With multimodality, if we take an image, it's going to disassemble that image into a series of objects. Your process with your framework is to pass that to a series of humans for verification and to have a continuous process so that you can make sure that it doesn't start to veer away from what the object actually is. Is it a cat? Is it a dog? Is it a leopard? Is it a man in a cat suit? But that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And that's great if you are able to monetize that. But for most people, that's not where they are going to look to use multimodality, is it?
No. And I would say it very much comes into the training side or the development side. You're absolutely right that from a commercial standpoint, it's part of your development cost that goes into the resulting products that do commercialize and monetize. It does create an interesting case where you think about open source, where we do see Meta with Llama. I'm going to say as open as I have seen generative AI. There's a whole different topic in there that I'd be happy to dive into another time. We do see even open source models need that development cost. Otherwise, what you're releasing into the open source market will have a lot more inherent bias, may not be able to perform equivalently to closed sourced models.
You've just released your multimodal framework. That's come after your agentic multimodal framework, both of which are built on the same base technology. Do you see people now using the agents, using the multimodal framework together to do their initial training and identification and then unleashing the agents across a much broader spectrum of content in the same way that we will perhaps use in cybersecurity, we'd use our logs and our alerts to say, this is all normal. This one needs a bit of looking at.
With both our agentic framework and our multimodal framework, there's multiple phases of AI development. There's the before you're alive, and then, oh my gosh, how is it being used by the real world? One of my favorite videos is a dad sitting with his son, and he asks him, can you tell me how to make peanut butter sandwich, and I will follow your steps. The kid says, okay, so take the knife and scoop peanut butter. So he turns the knife around the wrong way, grabs it by the blade, sticks the handle in, and the kid's like, no, what are you doing? And that's exactly how all software development for all time has been, including AI, no difference there. What we do see is you have a much more known world when you're in your development phase, where obviously you try to think of everything you can. You use frameworks to try to have good coverage across areas. But once you get into that real world, we do apply that same set of frameworks and multimodality frameworks in order to understand how is it actually being used by the core user base. And you said it's really important to try to find, like with logs in cybersecurity, what are the outliers here and are they valuable and important? One of the things that we use in these frameworks is working with our clients to identify, you want a small portion of the normal stuff because the world changes and you want to make sure the model's performing there. You really want to look for, how is this outside of the domains that you were expecting? How is this different usage? What about the patterns? And then we route that to humans as well, using humans in the loop in our platform in order to review that, to make sure that the model is being used in the right way and the kinds of responses it's giving make sense for our clients. One of the large trends that I've seen is that there's been a lot of push to have either all the disclaimers in the world written on it, you can't trust me. That doesn't really work for a lot of business applications. If you imagine going to your healthcare provider and they say, well, I'm going to give you some advice, but maybe that works or maybe that doesn't. Or if you try to log into your bank and transfer money between an account and pay a bill and say, well, maybe it'll work, but I can't promise you that it's going to work. Those are places where you need a higher level of trust and care. What we've seen with generative AI specifically is a lot more deployments for internal use cases. it's speeding up humans, but there's still a machine operator who's maybe overlooking 30 models at a time and just being that check before they get comfortable enough to say, okay, we've seen a good distribution that we're comfortable to get this out there, because your brand and your trust is absolutely everything in the
world. One of the reasons I was smiling and laughing here while you were talking about that trust and you used the bank software as an example is every single end user license agreement basically says, thank you for buying our product, but hey, we're just a research and development company. Don't come whining to us if it kills your business.
I'm going to differentiate there between what legally is true, which I agree with on the EULA and the, like, get into the whole how many people actually read it. Maybe a multimodal model can actually really help us assign and understand what a EULA is and whether we should agree to it. But it's about the trust of your product. It's not about the legal implication. And that's where you see much more potential damage for these companies.
Let's take this a little further into a use case. And I know you wanted to touch on autonomous cars. To me, when I look at the accidents and the incidents we've had with autonomous cars, they've come from things that a human would have seen. The ability of a human to differentiate that cyclist from some street furniture. The ability of a human at night to see that child come out from between the cars or from behind the bus, because they're aware, they're looking, they know that these are areas where things are happening. I've been in that situation where a child has run down the side of a street. I was driving slowly at that point because I was in traffic. I saw the child look at the sweet shop. I was already on my brake when he took off in front of me, and I still ended up just clipping him. An autonomous vehicle would not have braked, because it would not have had those markers of child looking at sweet shop, opposite side of the road, this is going to happen. How does multimodal AI using the LiDAR and the cameras and everything else make that vehicle as safe as it would be if I was in control?
That's a really interesting use case. There's some really good data from Waymo that is published their safety reports. They've crossed 50 million driverless miles, no one behind the wheel. They're 9 times fewer incidences. They go into quite detail in the report. The interesting thing about autonomous vehicles and humans is that you can have a much safer system. Let's say autonomous vehicles, we're 20 years down the track and great, autonomous vehicles are way safer than humans. The Venn diagram of when a human will make an error and when an autonomous vehicle will make an error, these do not touch. I would argue that there is almost no world in which they touch. Because looking at, say, in the US here with our NHTSA, our National Highway Transit Safety Authority, they publish the reports on accidents. And the vast majority of accidents are when we get distracted, whether I'm tired, changing the radio, not paying attention, unfortunately, in some cases, drunk, all those other areas. AI doesn't get tired. It doesn't get distracted. It doesn't do all those things. But as you said, it's the edge cases where human intelligence and the human brain, the multimodality, just gets the context of what you're doing. I have seen some autonomous vehicle companies, as they're progressing, are doing things like tracking the eye movement of pedestrians so that they've got an idea of how they intend to do it. And they've got really good motion tracking. If you're moving in a direction, what might you do? But you're right, there are going to be cases where a human would just be like, hey, my gut's telling me that's going to happen. And yes, there'll be some advantages over time of seeing enough of those edge cases. It's going to be a long time before we cover that. But how do I think multimodality plays in? The reason I said there are all these human errors that machines won't make. Some of the advantages of, say, having LiDAR is it doesn't care if it's dark or if it's bright. There's a couple of different instances where you can do both the dark and the light version where, yes, on an autonomous vehicle, if it's dark and you've just got RGB cameras, yeah, dark can still be a problem. But you can also have an infrared camera, great at night, really, really, really good. LiDAR, fantastic at night. Radar, fantastic at night. But as a driver, you're on a hill and you're just at the right version with the sun and you're squinting to try to make out what's there, not a problem for LiDAR. There's a lot of different modalities that by having those multiple modalities, we'll really be able to reduce the predictable ones.
But that raises another question. When we look at desktop systems where we use multimodal AI and we look at the processing power and the cost required to do this in CPU cycles and everything else, and then we look at the processing power and capability in a car, we run into this problem of, in a complex environment such as a city center, we have car companies talking about offloading to small local data centers that are almost sitting on most street corners in order to be able to pick up the signal and process it to send it back. That's a delay and that's an area of problem. Can we get the processing into the car to do true multimodal as we want it to happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what you're talking about is what's called V2X. So that means the vehicle to, in this case, infrastructure, V2I. And there's also talk about having standards where they have to have vehicle-to-vehicle communication. So if you've got two autonomous vehicles, if one can see around the corner and know that something's coming in a big way, it can let the car behind it know. And so it can proactively slow down, for example. But those are very non-real-time requirements. What I think you're talking about is when we talk about milliseconds being added, or seconds would be horrific. The decision making has to be so fast, and it has to go all the way from the sensor is sending out light, getting light back, all the way to it goes to a computer. You need to process it, make predictions, decide what you're going to do. Then you have to hit the brakes. The brakes are still the same brakes that you and I have in our cars. They're not magic brakes. They can actuate them a lot faster, but they're still the same. We're still living in a physical world using physics and a lot of mechanics here and actuator speeds. We have seen the ability to process it live. Are we processing it as well as we could? The continued following of Moore's law. Just look at any of the major NVIDIA conferences or anything similar. The ability for much more compute at much lower power requirements. And by the way, that's where a lot of it comes down to, is how long can I have an electric or gasoline vehicle out on the road? How much energy is it going to use? How much heat is it going to give off? And by the way, now that we're having specific AI, specific chipsets as well, it's allowing the processing power to meet those needs. We have seen both Zooks that's now live on the road. We have Waymo that's live in multiple cities. It is possible, and they're all doing it in vehicle without a requirement to send data to the cloud and come back to do it in real time. To see it in production cars at a cost that makes sense for a non-rideshare vehicle, like an L4 that you buy and own most of the time, I still think we're a couple of generations of chips away from that. That could only be 2 years given NVIDIA conferences.
So let's look at a different use case then, and one that applies to where I live. I live in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by fields. Most of them are potatoes, and they go to a specific company here that produce crisps. You call them chips in America. But we also have a lot of soft fruit here. We've got robots that will pick soft fruit like strawberries. The only reason that they're seen as more effective than people is because they run 24/7, but they're nowhere near as fast as identifying diseased fruit or damaged fruit. When we think now of somebody packaging at a distribution plant, fruit or some other form of foodstuffs, do you see a place for multimodal systems that are not just using cameras, but are using other semi-autonomous, maybe even fully autonomous systems that can identify the fruit or the food, work out whether it's safe, not safe, and then more importantly, work out the correct way to package that particular item so that you don't get something in a ridiculously large packaging container, which is what Amazon at the moment likes to do.
I would also argue one of my big frustrations, once again, having children, is how many berries I have to buy. Down at my local grocery store getting things, they come in a container, and I have to check the container because invariably most of them have, where's the squished berry or three squished berries? Now I'm making a decision between which has the highest percentage of non-bad fruit in it that I'm paying for. I do see a future where you can have multiple modalities. I can think of a few in that case where you can have a combination of sensory and touch for how's the suppleness of the fruit. You've got the camera visual detection. There's also some interesting pieces around looking at some of the chemical signatures that are being given off. So as fruits ripen or overripen, they can give off different ethyls and different chemical signatures for a autonomous system capability. I find a very relatable one is you could think of it like a robot with hand type things, camera type eyes, and maybe one of its fingers has the chemical sensor if you want to make it easier to understand. As you pointed out about the 24 hours a day, they're going to be slow. But the interesting thing about something slow that works 24 hours and you only need to buy it mostly once or pay a low subscription fee for it is that whole factory is going to need to be larger but it's going to be a lot more efficient over time. As you said, you're going to get things packaged nicely. They're going to be protected. So when I go to the grocery store in the future, I won't be wondering to myself, how many squished berries are there? I'm going to know that they're all going to be good because they followed through this process. I do definitely see that multimodality helping us with that future.
That's an edge case potentially at the moment, because there's not a lot of food manufacturers in that position to be looking at that. More common is for luxury goods manufacturers. There are several AI systems that I've seen in the last year, and they've built on high-speed cameras that look at lines, that can detect stitching or all sorts of other minutia that are critical to high-end luxury manufacturers. But they're also important when you have customs officers examining large amounts of goods to see what is counterfeit and what isn't. What do you see happening in retail? Do you see retailers being willing to build their own systems for their own production lines at the high-end luxury market and then license that to people who are dealing with import, like customs officers and trading standards bodies?
An interesting one, we work with a client that does fraud detection for brand fraud on websites like Amazon and Alibaba. They work with multiple clients across multiple verticals, and we help them develop these technologies. So what you're going to find is that, similar to most technologies, is that you start out with the leaders, the innovators, doing it themselves, and it's a really good differentiator for them. What you find is that at the economies of scale, if you can develop a solution that can apply to multiple industries or clients, is that you're going to be cost competitive, or you're going to beat the in-house development option. I'm certainly seeing that from a direct client perspective even now, where you've got to be doing it yourself. You've got to be able to find the ROI. The big trend I've seen very closely is a lot of AI teams, even the ones that are in the cutting edge, are being asked very hard questions about the ROI of what they're doing.
One area that becomes perhaps a little bit controversial is using this to detect fraud. We know banks and other people use a lot of systems. They listen to voice. They look at body language on camera. But actually, those systems are incredibly hard to train. They're incredibly prone to bias and error. You call out the ability to train multimodal as a way to reduce error. How do you see that playing out? Because finance isn't something you call out on your website as a targeted industry yet.
That's fair. In terms of the large sets of data, when you talk about large volumes of data, whether, you know, similar to looking through cybersecurity logs, or whether it's looking at banking transactions, or whether you're looking at errors or feedback from voltages on a machine, those are much more data science approaches in order to identify errors. Whereas, as I said, we're focused on the human intelligence piece, where you need that as part of what you're looking at.
Which is why I was suggesting the fraud and people.
It's one we've talked about with clients. The multimodality and how it can reduce it is that, you're right, is that especially on the bias side, is that the more sensors, and you'd be surprised that there are some really interesting multimodality use cases. One that you didn't mention, for example, when you're saying, oh yeah, you can listen to their voice, you can observe them. On our website, we have key point frames where we've done skeleton and hand gestures and motions. We've done facial detection for different emotional attributes. Also, I want to point out that infrared cameras can help you detect when you're having changes in body temperature. You can add a lot more detail, but I think, to your point, it's much more about reducing the false positives. I think the industry has actually done a reasonably good job of being able to say, oh, we think someone's lying here. We think there's something off about this. There's very few who can pass that. You can include a whole load of other people in that mix. And what we've seen from those kinds of systems is it basically flags for human review. And so you still have that internal team of experts that is making that final decision. It's now the AI is not the final decision maker. It's really saying, hey, I need a human to look at this.
Now, that's really important, because I covered IBM an awful lot when it moved into launching its machine learning and then its AI products. One of the paranoia points it had was the idea that Watson would be referred to as Dr. Watson. Even today, it continually stresses that this is an advisory system. It is not a clinician's decision-making system. It helps you. The same is true whether that be police or whether that be banks, and all this issue about handing it back to a human. But we know that, quite simply, companies are lazy. People are lazy. That's why the phrase, "the computer said no," Here's a very common thing we hear. How do we ensure, and potentially this needs to be a compliance-driven thing from government, that we don't end up using multimodal systems, as we've been talking here, to replace that human in-the-loop decision-making?
I love HMI just as a general topic, and this is fascinating for me. We also deal with this internally. So one of the things we use AI for, I said I run our machine learning team, we often do pre-annotations. So we look at a picture, we want to identify the cat, as you said before. We have an AI take a first pass. That helps accelerate, because the value is not in a human clicking and drawing a box on a screen. The value is a human going, yeah, I know that's a cat, or no, I know that's a man in a cat suit, that's not a cat. One of the things that we found is that there is this confirmation bias where, oh yeah, just whatever the AI says, just click the button and you'll be fine. I would love to see it develop, and I think it'd be interesting to see this from a regulatory standpoint in its critical systems. We've seen in the European Union regulations around AI is the system's criticality. So things like, I don't know if you're deciding whether I get a job or not, whether you're deciding to arrest me or not, or even investigate me because I'm just out walking or not, there is certainly a bar that needs to be required there. And one of the things that we found internally for us is that you need to introduce what we call gold tasks. What that means is we intentionally give you some questions that we already know the answer to. It's not to trick you. It's to see if you are complying and thinking and just saying yes to whatever the AI says. So we can take a man in a cat suit and say, yep, that's a cat. And if you just pass that on, then we have the ability to then say, hey, hold on, stop for a second. This was a trick. You need to pay more attention here. And we found that that really can help raise the rates of not just saying yes because the AI said so.
Sort of the AI equivalent of the camera in my car that notices when my eyes are getting tired or when I'm not paying attention to the road, especially at night.
Yep. And this gives a beep, beep, beep. And you're like, oh God. Yep. Okay. And you know, even if it gives a false detection occasionally, you're like, okay, well, I'm awake, you stupid camera. But at least you're having that thought process.
So where does this go from here? Do you see you building different frameworks for different industries? Or do you see yourself creating a generic framework that can be easily applied to multiple industries?
It's a generic framework that we've seen. We haven't seen a problem yet that the frameworks don't apply to, both on agentic and on multimodality. And we've also built our technology that way. So we can plug and play each modality with each other, whether it's text, images. We don't have all modalities at this stage. For example, we don't have DICOM at the moment for medical imaging. That's just an area we're not playing in at this particular stage. But we can take all the modalities we have, and we continue to add more every month to be able to put them together in new and interesting ways. And the reason we found that to be so important and a core architectural choice of how we built our platform is the world is going to continue to evolve at such a rate that I can't accurately predict which way you're going to add modalities together for a particular use case. And so it gives us the flexibility to be able to cover a huge range of use cases with this framework.
The other thing that I found interesting looking around your website was there doesn't seem to be a partner program. If we look at the cost of training, we look at the complexity of training objects in different modalities, there's only so much you can do within the funding that you're going to be able to raise to do that and then try and monetize that. But there is a lot of people out there who've got specialized databases, who historically have built those databases as part of photo libraries that they've then monetized. It seems there's an opportunity here for those people to build plug-in libraries that would work within your framework. At what point do you start to address them? And at what point do you start to decide we're going to do it ourselves?
I will also add on top of that synthetic data, generating new data, even if it's not real. So there's both real world data and then synthetic. I put them both in this category. We really assess deeply, do we want to do this? We've got clients who have asked for a specific data in the past. We've made recommendations. We've connected them to database providers of these kinds of things, even synthetic data providers. The thing that has stopped us is that the data across use cases is so different that for us to be able to build sufficiently large libraries or sufficiently accurate synthetic data across different use cases is ridiculously hard. And so you'd be going after each industry and use case and then build a synthetic data solution or collect a set of data. and then the next one, and then the next one. And the problem is we actually serve such a broad set of use cases and industries that that doesn't make it financially viable for us. So we do work with a partner network, but we have that more on the back end once we're engaging with the client on recommendations for within different areas for those.
Let's turn to another industry and one that is struggling with what's going on with AI, and that's music. We've talked about some degrees of false positive just now, determining a cat from a man in a cat suit. We've seen a lot of lawsuits over the last few years where people have looked at one or two bars of music. The problem with music is there's only a given number of notes and a given number of ways you can arrange those notes and a given number of length of every note. Is there a space here where people can start to apply AI and multimodal within music, but then misuse it, as we've seen in courts of law with people making up legal documents, by misunderstanding what they're listening to, and we end up being swamped with frivolous complaints, because that becomes the dark side potentially of multimodal?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially as we add generative into the mix, where you're now just, hey, how do I take this content and generate this over there? You mentioned in a good way in terms of a legal system, I've seen a lot of this already happen within video content. Think about, say, YouTube, for example. When you upload a video to YouTube, it checks that you're not using copyrighted music. A whole load of machine checks are done, and it's much more on the enforcement side with platforms and things like that that is going to be the solution, as opposed to getting the legal system to appropriately. Yes, they need to enable that. That's fine for them to be able to do. But I don't think we're going to see that as a way to get rid of the volume of lawsuits that we're going to potentially see, especially as you see the proliferation of being able to generate your own social media networks, your own applications, your own video hosting platform using generative AI so quickly, that I think that'll be very difficult. I'm hoping that we could see perhaps the reduction in frivolous cases where you've got, say, AI doing the first pass. For example, with YouTube, when you upload a video, it says, sorry, this is copyrighted material. You can appeal for that, but the vast majority who are like, oh, I didn't realize I had a Disney track playing in that, let me cut out that audio piece and then I can re-upload it. That's the approach that I think would be better, but I'd like to see it on the legal side as well. Same with cases. Like, do we need, I'm personally disappointed that 80% of the world's lawyers are in America. As an originally an Australian and now an American, I'm like, yeah, no, it rings true, but does it need to be?
So here's probably the big tricky question right at the end for you. When we talk about multimodality and its ability to be our senses, to see as we do, hear as we do, taste, smell, all those things that make us essentially human when we interact, at what point do we run the risk of enabling the replacement of people with robotics?
Oh, a great question. All the insert normal arguments of industrial revolution. If you'd asked 3 or 4 years ago about a prompt engineering job, someone would have said, a what? Jobs that are now very expensive and well off, but it's accurate. As we're now coming to terms with the fact that the rate of development of AI is going to have a significant impact on human jobs as we see them today. The question is, I don't think we can see yet what those jobs of the future are going to be. I think about this a lot, especially the role I play and how I choose to spend my time and my work time to do this. What could that future look like? As I've mentioned several times to this, I've got 4 kids, so I'm also thinking, what's their work life going to look like? What's meaningful contribution to society and ability to earn enough income to have a comfortable enough life look like for them? And it's one that I don't have a crystal ball on. I've got several thoughts. You know, some of them go down to the dark side of the, okay, so there's going to be some financial collapses at some certain points in here is, oh my God, I'm completely cheap everything. Okay, but what happened to debt that we had before? Ooh, okay, there's some things there. And all the way to sort of the Star Trek utopia where, okay, great, where if everything's cheap, then we can have universal incomes. So from that side, and I haven't seen enough thought put into it. And I certainly haven't seen enough from either technology companies that are displacing these jobs. I don't think it's their natural place there, or governments to really look at how are we going to think about ourselves as a society and people and take care of the people in the right way as we make these transitions.
One area that appeals to me for multimodal is in highly dangerous environments, nuclear, chemical, oil and gas, where we have plenty of sensors, But that sensor now triggers because it thinks it detects a particular chemical formula in the air. But now I've got to try and direct cameras to see where that might be coming from. Is that an accidental release? Is that a standard release? It's just a safety valve popping. Is that something more serious? The idea of being able to send in something with multimodal sensors that can combine them at the same time and use them to do that view. Today, we still send a human into that environment.
I was thinking about Fukushima. One of the things about that story that was very heart-touching was there was a group of the elderly who decided, hey, we'll go in and help because we haven't got long to live because we need to stop this from blowing up. Would have been much better if we could have sent multimodal robots in. Or if you've got a chemical fire, there's a lot of different places where we could send a lot more help if we're willing to risk that compared to a human life. I do think that's an amazing opportunity for us there.
I'm fascinated to see where multimodal takes us. I'm fascinated to see what it adds to the AI story. Duncan, thank you for spending some time with me today.
No problem, Ian. Thanks. This was really fun. I had a great time. Appreciate it.